settle the bill. Evan handed Tommy a thick roll of $100 bills. Tommy hefted it as if gauging its weight, then smiled his gap-toothed smile and tapped the roll into his shirt pocket. Evan looked at the aluminum forging.
You said you had the upgrades for me?
Tommy crossed his arms, mock annoyed. Hey, Tommy, by the way, thanks for producing a cutting torch, a suppressed subgun, and a skiff for me out of thin air from 10 states away on 24 hours' notice.
Right, Evan said. Thank you.
Tommy jabbed at Evan with a forefinger that had been blown off at the second knuckle.
And a grappling fucking hook.
And a grappling fucking hook.
And how have you been, Tommy?
He said, circling his hand in a prompt. Evan said,
How have you been?
Tommy shrugged, dropped the shit-slinging routine.
Nothing but high-speed, low-drag antics here. This new broad I'm seeing, she wanted me to try yoga. I told her I wasn't in touch with my inner vagina enough, you know.
He raised that stub of a forefinger.
Then I tried that shit, and I realized, I'm not in touch with my inner fucking seal enough.
It's that hard? Evan asked. Tommy dug through the mound of Ares frames, grabbed one in particular. He'd machined out the interior, drilling the pivot points for the fire control group. Pistol frame in hand, he limped back toward his workbench.
Those skinny bitches, they can balance on a pinky finger for longer than I can stand up anymore.
So you're doing yoga now?
Hell no. But I will tell you, yoga pants, best invention of the past 100 years. Let's just say downward dog gives me upward dog. But even that ain't worth it.
Tommy half tilted, half fell into his rolling chair. Though he never talked about where or how he'd served, he had enough hearing loss, blown-out joints, and surgical scars for Evan to know he'd been a tip-of-the-spear operator. He was banged up in all the right ways. Now he worked as a contract armorer for various government-sanctioned black groups, specializing in procurement and R&D. Or at least that's what Evan had gleaned. Their conversations had always been light on proper nouns. Tommy's shop, a desert-baked building rearing up from the sand in off-the-strip Vegas, looked like an auto shop from the outside. Few people knew its location, and fewer yet had earned the right to visit. Tommy kept a surveillance camera at the door, which he'd unplugged when Evan called on him. Tommy took a swig of black coffee across a lower lip packed with Skoal Wintergreen.
I got no interest in working out no more. Makes no sense at this point. Spend what, 2 hours a day? They say exercising can add 7 years onto the end of your life. But I figure those 7 years are about what you get if you add up all the hours you'd spend sweating your sorry ass on a treadmill. So I figure, why not skip all that misery, live out the good days, and hit the dirt when it's time?
He rolled the chair away from the ammo and over to his smoking station. An ashtray made from a ship's battered porthole. A Camel Wide lipped out from the edge. He pulled on the cigarette, then dropped it into a red keg cup filled with water. A kick of his combat boots set him shooting back across the floor toward Evan. Even as he glided, he popped a new slide assembly onto the aluminum frame.
Don't get me wrong. I don't want to slow down. You know me. Animal from the Muppets is my spirit animal.
He leaned over the pistol at his bench, adding the extras.
But man, I'll tell you, more and more I feel like I've been shot at and missed and shit at and hit.
He paused to flex his remaining 9 fingers, working out a cramp. Evan thought of a seam with his hand tremors and unsteady gait, the physical toll of a lifetime of rough play. Was this what was in store for them all? A hard end? To a hard life?
I wanted you to get out. I wanted you to have a chance.
It was nearly impossible for Evan to recalibrate to the fact that Jack was still alive, that when he heard Jack's voice in his head, it was not from beyond the grave. Tommy had said something. Evan snapped, too. What?
You lose your holster, too.
Yeah.
I need a Kydex high guard. I know what you use. Tommy scooped the wad of long-cut tobacco from his lip, thumbed it into an empty Red Bull can, washed out his mouth with more Java sludge. How do you misplace your gear? Got held up by a troop of Girl Scouts?
It's a long story.
Ain't they all?
Tommy handed over the new 1911. 8 in the mag, 1 in the spout. High-profile, straight 8 sights. Low ambidextrous thumb safety, since Evan preferred to shoot southpaw. Aggressive front frame checkering. Extended barrel, threaded for a suppressor. Beaver tail grip safety so it wouldn't fire if not in hand. Matte black, to disappear in shadow. It wasn't merely sterilized. It had never had a serial number. A ghost weapon that, like Evan, did not exist. Evan hefted the Ares.
It's lighter. Bet your ass it's lighter, Tommy said. Thing practically floats. But everything else is as lined out as the steel Wilsons I used to make you. His biker mustache shifted above his grin. It's just homemade.
Evan handed him another wad of hundreds and stood.
Hold up, Hoss.
Tommy slipped the cash into his shirt pocket.
When have I ever let you leave without test driving a new gun?
He chinned at the sand-filled steel pipe slanted downward next to the cutting torch.
Eyes and ears are in the bin.
Evan donned protective gear and then fired a full mag down the mouth of the pipe. The gun, tuned with throat ramp work, fed smoothly. When Evan turned around, Tommy had tugged out his earplugs, one cheek gathering to the side in a fan of wrinkles.
You okay? Evan asked. Tinnitus. From all the...
Tommy waved a hand by his head.
I live with it non-stop, pretty much. I think of it as a reminder of all the shit I've done. Jiminy Cricket in there, making sure I don't forget a red second of it.
His smile was bittersweet.
Every year, I feel like I'm hanging on to a little less. And for a little less. You know?
Evan clicked the Ares into his Kydex holster. I know, he said. 67. What was missing? Kraft First Poster Restoration would have been a sweatshop if everyone weren't so well paid. Rows and rows of foreign workers toiling over screw presses and wet tables, spraying surfactants and dabbing at one sheets with needle-thin paintbrushes. The operation, located at the back of an industrial park in Northridge, made money in a variety of ways. The woman at the helm specialized in bringing rare posters and documents back to their original form. She also happened to be the finest forger Evan had encountered. He had spent the past week poring over the investigation documents and pounding the databases, looking for any buried thread that might lead to Rene Casseroy. Chasing down leads in the IRS documents, he'd uncovered a host of addresses on various continents. Many forwarded on to additional addresses in Croatia, Togo, the Republic of Maldives, and other nations lacking extradition treaties with the U.S. Evan had plenty such addresses himself, some no more than an office front set up to throw trackers off course. To get beyond the long arm of the FBI, Rene had probably retreated to one of these countries, but which one was anyone's guess. Evan could spend a lifetime trekking around the globe, knocking on doors, sticking out P.O. boxes, and talking to shady middlemen, unless he produced a concrete lead, which was why he was here. Way across the floor, Melinda Truong balanced atop a ladder, reaching for a box at the top of a rise of industrial shelving. A sea of male workers milled nervously at the base of the ladder, calling up to her with gentle admonitions and offers of help. As she grabbed the box, One hip swung wide in a balance beam correction, her waist-long black hair flinging wide like a flicked horsetail. A collective gasp went up. The building itself seemed to hold its breath. Melinda righted herself and hopped down the ladder, her neon Nikes striking every other rung. At the bottom, she presented the open box of X-Acto blades to an assistant, and then scolded her workers in Vietnamese for doubting her. "Now get to work. I don't pay you to worry." Nodding respectfully, they hurried back to their workstations. They were all half terrified of her, and half in love with her. For good reason. Dusting her hands, she noticed Evan threading his way through the tables toward her, and grinned. "And here I thought you'd forgotten all about me," she said, reaching up to take his face in her hands. Impossible. On tiptoes, she kissed both of his cheeks, cheating to catch the edge of his lips. "What do you need, darling? Another driver's license? Death certificate? Fresh passport for that getaway you're gonna take me on to Turks and Caicos?" "I need your brain," he said. She crossed her arms. An Olympos double-action airbrush dangled from her hip. She'd padded the futuristic grip with pink tape to ensure that no one borrowed it. As the only woman in the building, she color-coded all her tools. "My brain? I don't know whether to be flattered or insulted." "Flattered? It's a magnificent brain." She noticed one of her conservators sponging roughly at a Polish poster of Rebecca and smacked his shoulder. "Careful. She's been through a lot, that poor girl. Show her some care. Handle her gently, like a lover." Taking Evan by the arm, she snapped back to English. "I feel sorry for Min's wife. In bed she must feel like hamburger meat." She walked as she talked, casting an eagle eye across the workstations. "I'm trying to find a man," he said.
"Me too."
A sideways glance.
"Okay, okay. Let's find your man. It'll bring some excitement to my life."
"I doubt your life lacks excitement."
"Let me cook you dinner sometime, and you can find out."
"Deal. But for now,
a man."
"Yes. I believe he's left the country. He's off the radar, and he's been careful to cover all the usual bases. I was in his house, briefly. It was filled with luxury items, some rare. I'm hoping I can track him through unusual purchases he's made."
"Why that approach?"
"Because," Evan said, "that's how he tracked me."
"No, no, no."
She paused by a giant plywood work table, lifting the padded earphone free of a painter's head to shout in his ear.
"Use Bestine to remove the tape adhesive residue."
She let the headphone snap back to the man's skull and kept on.
"So you'd like to track down which purchase?"
"He had an original Monet."
"How could you tell it wasn't a fake?"
"I'm pretty sure.
If I made it, you wouldn't be able to tell."
"I'm assuming you didn't make it." She gave a demure tilt of her chin. "Proceed." "It was of water lilies."
"Of course," she said. "It's always water lilies with him. How many water lilies can a guy paint?"
"He didn't just do water lilies."
"Right. Haystacks. Lots of haystacks." She sighed.
"Give me a Metropolis poster from the 30s any day.
Have you seen the Boris Karloff Frankenstein? It just went at auction for..."
"Can you track a Monet like that?"
"Evan, the guy painted hundreds of them. Plus the forgeries. Only Starry Night's been knocked off more. Even if you knew it was real, how could you tell which water lily painting it was? They all look like, well, like water lilies."
From his jacket, Evan pulled the printouts of the crime scene pictures and fanned through them. But no dining room shot of the Monet had magically appeared since he'd last perused the stack. She read his face.
"I'm sorry. Was there anything else you saw in the house that you could track?"
"Lexan."
"What?"
bullet-resistant polycarbonate resin acquired on the black market. She screwed up her face.
Good luck there.
He shuffled the printouts. Files on a Pakistani rug. Punctured IV bags draining onto the basement floor. The barn interior. Two Mercedes Galandewagens and a wrestling mat. He stopped. Stared at the last photo. Not what was in it. But what was missing. Melinda's tiny hand gripped his elbow.
What?
A vintage Rolls. Evan had seen Dex drive away with it when he'd taken Despy, but it had never reappeared. Rene needed his toys. As his operation at the chalet drew to a close, he'd have wanted to get the car clear of the location, ready to meet him at his next stop. What had he said at the dinner table?
You could take silk sheets and caviar and inject them directly into my veins. His obsession with luxury might be the thing that exposed him.
What model was it? Melinda asked.
A Phantom.
That, she said, might prove useful. Evan stared at the photo taken outside the barn. The edge of the picture captured the bank of shoveled snow that rimmed the vehicle path. It was indented with dozens of notches made by the G-wagons when they'd backed up for their three-point turns. Evan focused on a particular imprint in the icy rise. Another bumper mark, much lower, studded with the rectangular outline of a license plate frame. But he knew there had been no license plate on the Rolls. As he squinted at the shape, Melinda leaned over him, her breath smelling of juicy fruit.
What?
She asked. The license plate indentation in the snow here. I don't remember it having.
We'll look at that in a minute, she said.
Right now, tell me, the Phantom. Was it a 1, 2, 3, 4?
How can you tell?
I can't. But come. She steered him between two wet tables, the mist from a retrofitted insecticide sprayer moistening their cheeks.
Quan?
Quan! A man in the far corner raised an arm hesitantly. Melinda beelined for him. He stood at attention as they approached. Covering his vast table, sandwiched between mylar sheets, were sales brochures for vintage automobiles.
You deal in car brochures? Evan said.
You'd be surprised, Melinda said. This Bugatti one here? It's worth nearly 300 grand. She looked at Quan. You need to help him identify a type of Rolls-Royce Phantom. She started to translate between the men, but Evan stepped in with badly accented Vietnamese. It had big fenders that swooped up over the front wheels, swept back pillars so the windshield was on tilt. And it had those things over the rear tires,
fender skirts,
with rivets.
Yes, the Brits, they call them spats.
Close-coupled body style?
I don't know what that means.
Was the passenger compartment somewhat short? Did it look zoomy?
Yes.
Like this? Quan tapped the mylar covering an old Rolls brochure.
Not exactly.
Quan bent over, rummaging beneath his stool, and came up with a coffee table book. Flipping through the pages.
This?
No.
This?
Too big.
This?
Yes.
It's a Phantom 3.
He smiled, showing crooked teeth.
Goldfinger's car.
How many were made? Quan consulted the book. 727 chassis. Less with the body you describe.
That's a lot of haystacks, Evan said to Melinda.
Already she'd clamped his hand in hers, yanking him along hard enough to put a sting in his shoulder. Before he could thank Quan, he'd been whisked down a back hall and into a dark-walled photography room with blacked-out windows. The most private space in the building, it was generally reserved for illicit document work. Melinda stopped by a desk, snapped her fingers impatiently. It took a moment for him to catch her meaning, and then he handed her the printout of the photo taken outside the barn. She slid it beneath an AMSCOPE binocular microscope, the enlarged image coming up on the connected computer. Twisting her long hair in a knot, she flipped it over her shoulder and leaned to the wide eyepiece mounted on a boom arm. She studied the license plate indentation in the snow. Evan did the same on the mirroring monitor.
"It looks like two stacked curves," he said. "Those aren't curves. They're bees. A big one perched on top of a smaller one."
"I don't get it." She snapped off the specialty bulbs illuminating the grainy picture and rotated to another computer, typing carefully on the keyboard so as to preserve her perfect nails. The search engine swiftly brought up a logo. Bonhams and Butterfields. Evan said,
"You're amazing. You ain't seen nothing yet."
A search field led to a database for collectors, which led to 5 Phantom 3s have been sold at Bonham since it consolidated with Butterfields in 2002, she said. 3 were bought by an Abu Dhabi sheik, 1 by that Ukrainian tennis player whose name I always screw up. And the 5th? She pointed. The screen read, "Anonymous buyer." "There's your boy," she said. "Does he have to register with them to put in a bid? Can you track him?" "Auction houses are extremely discreet when buyers desire privacy. So no, I can't track the buyer. However," her cheeks dimpled. She looked pleased with herself, a cat ready to be petted. "I can track the car." For the first time, Evan allowed excitement into his voice. "The car. The chassis number, to be precise. It has to be registered when moved between countries. There are duties to be paid, taxes, all sorts of annoying bureaucratic paperwork." "I can take it from here. Let me. We traffic in fine things. It's what we do." "How do I repay you?" She leaned to swing her rope of hair off her elegant neck and tapped her cheek. He kissed it. "I'll be in touch by day's end. Check your email." She rose, smoothed the wrinkles from her yoga pants, and dismissed him with a wave. "Now go on. Some of us have work to do."
68. Object Permanence. Evan hesitated outside the door of 12B. He and Mia had an understanding that he was to keep his distance from her and Peter. Mia didn't know precisely what sorts of jobs Evan did, but she'd learned enough to know that he wasn't safe to be around. He reached for the doorbell, but his finger stopped shy of the mark. What if she got angry? What if she told him to leave? What if Ted was there, whipping up an organic meal, expounding on the virtues of CrossFit? Evan glared at his finger, wavering in midair. Given everything he'd endured in his life, how absurd that pushing a doorbell made him nervous. He rang. After a long pause, he heard footsteps. "Damn it! Hang on! Hang on!" The door flung wide. She wore a bathrobe, soaked through, her wet hair dripping around her shoulders. One hand gripped a pink razor. "Oh," she said, cinching her bathrobe tighter. "I thought you were the pizza guy." She looked at her razor, then hid it behind her back.
Awkward.
"Sorry to bother you. I know I'm not supposed to."
"It's okay. It's good to see you. I mean, if I weren't in the middle of a shower and didn't have a Gillette Venus razor hidden behind my back."
"It's still there?"
She checked behind her. "Yep. Evidently I was hoping you hadn't developed object permanence yet."
"I've got it down pat. I do struggle with stranger anxiety, though."
"Okay." She bit her lower lip. "I'm all out of witty repartee and getting shivery. Can we move this along?"
"I just wanted to apologize to Peter for the lobby last week when I was short with him."
"He's in his room. He snuck his Halloween candy in there, so enter at your own risk. I'll be drying myself off and pretending not to eavesdrop through the heating vent.
Deal. She vanished up the hall, and he walked over to Peter's door. It had been a long time since he'd been down here. The Batman stickers remained, as well as the skull and crossbones, keep out sign. But the Kobe Bryant poster had been replaced with one of Steph Curry. The door was slightly ajar, and Evan knuckled it open. Peter started, diving to cover up the sea of dumped-out candy. He craned a look over his shoulder. Evan's smoke. Rolling out of his emergency belly flop, he pulled the Snickers Mini from a fold in his pajama top and started shoveling candy back into the pillowcase frantically.
Don't tell Mom.
His mouth was full, the words distorted. I wouldn't be shocked if she knows already. Chocolate smudged his cheek. His lips were raspberry blue. He chewed and swallowed.
Why do you think she knows?
Because your mom knows everything.
Why don't you visit anymore?
Evan resisted the urge to scratch at the remnants of the scabs on his neck.
Like we talked about. Your mom and I thought it'd be better if...
I still think it's dumb.
I understand that. Look, I just wanted to...
Hopped up on candy bars, Peter leapt to his feet, ran to his desk, and began frenetically coloring in a Star Wars drawing.
Did you know butterflies taste with their feet?
I did not.
What do you want to wear in your coffin?
A wetsuit.
Do frogs have penises?
Not the ones I've met. Listen, Peter, look at me. I wanted to say that I'm sorry.
He looked genuinely puzzled.
For what?
For how I was in the lobby.
You're right. I acted mean.
Oh. I forgot about that already. That was like years ago.
He set down his crayon, now worn to a nub, and looked at Evan.
Friends don't make a big deal over stuff like that, he said.
Evan had to clear his throat before he could respond.
Okay, he said. I hope you can come back sometime.
Me too.
Peter turned back to his coloring book, and Evan slipped out into the hall. He was feeling better every day. Just this morning he'd teased the sutures out of his shoulder with stitch scissors and needle-nose tweezers. He'd regained decent mobility with his right arm, though he had to be cautious about how far and how fast he pushed it. Oddly, his calf was bothering him more today, the nerve line like a twisting strand of barbed wire. He stopped in the living room to take in the place. Drying laundry covered the couch. Jazz played softly down the hall somewhere. Early Miles Davis. The air smelled of vanilla candles and hot chocolate and dish detergent. The kitchen trash can overflowed. A real home, in all its messy glory. The post-it stuck to the wall by the kitchen pass-through was more faded than when he'd seen it last. Written in Mia's scrawl. Treat yourself as if you were someone who you are responsible for helping. She posted these life lessons, lifted from a favorite book, around the condo for Peter to read. This one in particular had always given Evan pause. When he'd been trapped in that chalet, he'd been his own client for the first time, the one in need of rescuing. He wondered if he deserved the same happiness that he wished for the people he helped. Mia surprised him. How'd you do with the Duke of Sugarbuzz?
He was inquisitive.
Did he ask you if frogs have penises?
He did.
Mia toweled her hair some more.
Do frogs have penises? I don't believe they do.
Watching her laugh, he felt something tug at him.
What?
She said.
Nothing.
She bit her lower lip, studied him. And yet she hadn't asked him to sit.
I'd better go, he said, before you bust out that Gillette Venus razor again.
We wouldn't want that.
He started out.
He was at the door when she said, "I can't help but think that in some other life..." He turned. She looked at her nails, over his shoulder, everywhere but at him. "Where I'm not a DA and you're not a... whatever you are." He nodded. "But it's not safe for Peter," she said. "I could never put him at risk." "No," Evan said. "Never." "I wish it were different," she said. "Me too." "Goodbye, Evan Smoke." "Goodbye, Mia Hall." 69. No extradition. Before turning in for the night, Evan entered the vault and logged into the.nowhere.man@gmail.com. A single email waited for him from Melinda Trong. "A Rolls-Royce Phantom III 1936 sports limousine with a Hooper body, Sauchit chrome trim, and a chassis number of 9AZ161 passed through the port of Rijeka on Friday, October 28th. You're welcome. You can repay me by taking me to dinner. Or to Turks and Caicos. XOXO, MT." Evan cracked his knuckles, studied the screen. Rijeka. In Croatia. One of the countries that has no extradition treaty with the U.S. Evan reached for the IRS printouts, covered with his notes. On the backs of the pages, he'd scrawled all the addresses he'd turned up while trying to chart the sprawling map of Renee's financials. In 2008, one of Renee's attorneys had taken receipt of a quarterly distribution from a now-extinct umbrella corporation at a condo address in Zagreb. The building, a mere two-hour drive east of the port. Evan crossed the vault and spun the dial on his floor safe. Lifting the steel hatch, he reached inside for one of his passports. 70. The slightest misstep. It had been hell. Not just weathering Van Sciver's quiet rage, but being stuck with Ben Jaggers. And stuck with him Candy was, until the job was done. As if she needed another motivation to reduce Orphan X to ash. She sat in the driver's seat of a Passat wagon that had been advertised as family size. She mostly liked it for its trunk space. To avoid Jaggers's stink, she breathed through her mouth. But then she got worried about all that funk getting into her lungs, and so she went back to breathing through her nose and suffering silently. Croatia was amazing. More specifically, Croatian men were amazing. Tall and broad, full heads of lush dark hair, light eyes and golden skin. Like Olympic athletes, the whole lot of them. And they proclaimed their love so readily. On the first night, on the first meeting. Of course, Candy got that a lot. But she got it more in Croatia. When she wasn't stuck with Ben Jaggers, watching a luxury condo complex on a city center street crowded with exhaust-belching buses in a fucking Passat. Van Sciver, or more precisely, Van Sciver's room of supercomputers, had unearthed Renee's location fairly quickly after the chalet combustion. A hub of five major freeways, Zagreb is a confusion of bypasses and congestion. An ideal location for Renee to slip in and out of. Plenty of avenues for escape. But also plenty of stakeout spots like the one Candy and Jaggers had pinned down for the past week, parked off a major artery among a crowded lineup of other vehicles. Why couldn't it have been split with its view of the sparkling Adriatic, or Dubrovnik with stone city walls and hills of lavender? But no. Here she was in the Detroit of Croatia, stuck in a Volkswagen with that yellow bastard. A group of Croatian men dressed in soccer uniforms hopped off a bus ahead of them, joking and shoving one another, forked triceps and cleft chins. She felt taunted. A cat in an aquarium.
Are you watching the building?
Mm-hmm, Candy said, flicking her eyes back across the four lanes of traffic to the high-security condo complex. She resumed watching people trickle through the front gate. Fat woman with stroller, silver-haired captain of industry, three schoolgirls in fetching plaid skirts. Rene had already had his daily morning outing, a trip to a bakery for a croissant and juice, and to the drugstore for God knew what. Dex never left his side, his remaining hand shoved in his trench coat pocket, a lumbering gumshoe with a thyroid condition. Now they were back in the condo, a baited trap, and Candy had nothing to do but ogle soccer players, endure jaggers, and wait for Evan to show up. Under cover of night, jaggers had managed to get several hidden surveillance cameras up around the building's perimeter, streaming into the laptop that rested on the console between them. It was available for close-ups and replays, but over the past days they'd seen few customers worth a second look. Her phone sounded. Shakira's "Hips Don't Lie." She'd chosen the new ringtone mostly to annoy Jaggers, though he seemed annoyingly unannoyable. He just sat in the passenger seat as still as a frozen rat, an elaborate GPS unit resting across his stick-thin thighs. She picked up.
Status?
Up.
Date?
In clear view of restaurant. Still no sign of the expected party.
Lightning.
Bug is on stand.
Bye.
Await.
Ing coordinates.
For obvious reasons, Van Sciver had to keep the drone out of the air for as long as possible, which meant no sky surveillance. Once Candy and M confirmed Orphan X's precise location, they'd input it into the handheld GPS unit. An unmanned armed aerial vehicle would flash above the thick clouds, and Zeus would hurl a thunderbolt from the heavens. There'd be no collateral damage. No non-collateral damage either, if you thought about it. If you killed the Nowhere Man, did anyone really die? The targeted zap would get blamed on Hamas or Israel or some shit. That was up to Van Sciver to figure out. He was delighted to have a shot off U.S. soil and wasn't going to miss his chance. One of the joys of operating Oconus was that there was no hue and cry over ROEs and constitutional rights and court precedents. There was a guy one moment and a crater the next, and then everyone standing around with their hands in their pockets, shrugging. The GPS unit in Orphan M's lap mapped the street and the surrounding buildings, drilling down coordinates using not degrees but minutes and seconds, which were accurate to 1/3,600th of a degree, precise enough to guide a missile through a donut. The thing even accounted for minute tectonic crustal movement, Jaggers had informed her fetishistically. She'd told him that that sounded like a medical condition. Candy focused again on her call with Van Sciver. I was still hoping to have a more leisurely meal with the diner, she said. They'd been over this.
The coordinates,
the collection of anonymous voices said.
And then,
dessert! The line cut out. Evan sat in the bay window of the boutique hotel overlooking the crowded Zagreb city center, an open laptop resting on the cushion beside him. He had a clean sight line to the third floor of the condo building across the street where Rene Casseroy was bedded down. Dex was there as well, in a connecting condo. Evan was still recovering full use of his right arm, but Dex was missing a hand, so he figured that put them no more uneven than they'd been before. At least Evan still had two opposable thumbs. He hoped to put them to good use. He'd have to be extremely cautious in his approach to ensure that no communication went out to the men watching Despy. The slightest misstep could trigger a text or a call, and she'd be dispensed of as proficiently as her parents and sister had been.
Evan could understand why Renee had chosen to hide here. Several prominent businessmen and ministers lived in the complex, which was riddled with security cameras. Logging on to the internet, Evan accessed an untraceable account at Hashkiller and sent its 131 billion password dictionary to work. Within minutes, he was on the luxury condo building's network. He found the security camera system next, matching the name to the decals on the building's main fence. Hashkiller made short work of that, and then 100+ internal and external camera feeds appeared. He picked the lenses along the route he was planning to take, and then opened up the camera control links. First, he slewed the pan-tilt zoom lens above the front gate to face the sun. The image turned a uniform white. The neighboring ones he aimed directly at streetlights, to the same effect. The cameras on the interior east stairwell didn't have the same operability, so he turned off their auto-irising and then directed them to stop down. The pictures went black. In case Renee had hacked into the security cameras on his own floor, a likely precaution, Evan took a single frame of valid video from each one, duplicated it 50 million times, and injected the gapless IP feed back into the video storage server. This created a spoof of each camera's normal scene, showing forever empty corridors. Snapping the laptop shut, he stood, stretched out his shoulder, and headed for the door. It was time. 71. Vaporized. Candy cracked her window to get a little fresh air and leaned away, not wanting to get sucked into the black hole of Jaggers's charisma void. He sat motionless in the passenger seat, his hands on the GPS unit as if about to embark on a game of Super Mario. She monitored the residents and visitors entering the condo building's front gate. Old woman with a purse dog. Hipster with sleeve tattoos and a slouch beanie cap. Ladies who lunched in pink pantsuits and glittering pearls. Halia Bardakshi, she murmured. Though she stared straight ahead, she sensed Orphan M's head dart over. What? That was her name. The girl you killed in the alley outside Sevastopol. He picked up the laptop and reviewed footage. How do you know? Candy kept her eyes on the luxury complex. Elderly couple. Teenage girl with bad eyeshadow. A diplomat's wife who resembled a drag queen. I read the news story, Candy said. She was just a down-on-her-luck kid. Bushy-mustached businessman. Swarthy janitor. Strapping college girl. What does that matter? Jaggers asked. Because, you dickless fuck, Candy said. She could have been us. Jaggers jolted in his seat, and for an instant she thought he might strike her. But his eyes remained glued to the laptop. He'd screen-captured the image of the hipster who'd entered the building earlier and zoomed in on the face, barely visible beneath the beanie cap. Fuck, Candy said. Make sure that he's inside Renee's condo, Jaggers said. And ascertain which room. Already the coordinates. The last thing we need is him getting away singed. Candy grabbed her phone and hopped out of the car. Jaggers called after her. And V? She leaned back in. If you worried more about surveillance and less about a dead Crimean whore, we could have sizzled him at the front gate. She slammed the door harder than necessary and jogged for the building. The need raged and gnashed inside him. Without his infusions of young blood, Renee could already chart his deterioration. Achy joints, flagging energy, and that chalky residue always in his mouth. The taste of aging. As soon as they coaxed the nowhere man out of hiding, Dex would put an end to him, and they could set about rebuilding a new medical lab and acquiring new products. Rising from his midday nap, Renee shuffled from the king-size bed toward the makeup counter of the bathroom suite.
The windows were Lexan, of course, but to deter surveillance, he kept the curtains drawn and the lights off. Just across the tile floor of the interior hall, the connecting door to Dex's condo was in clear view. It was closed for privacy, though given all the cameras they'd installed throughout the rooms, privacy was hardly an issue. When Dex wasn't at Renee's side, he kept watch on every inch of Renee's quarters from a collection of monitors next door, ready to alert their Greek freelancers at the first sign of anything out of the ordinary. It would take the tap of an iPad, no more, and hired knives would close in on Despy and carve her to pieces. Dex had plans for Evan after that. He'd made multiple contingencies for how to eliminate him once he appeared. Disguised gun ports in the common walls, auto-locking double-cylinder deadbolts on the solid-core front door to block egress, vents wired up for gas, just as in the chalet. Rene braced himself for a look in the mirror. Despite the low-light conditions, he winced at the sight. It was getting harder and harder to produce his confected self. Thinning hair swirled up from his pate. The bags under his eyes had grown bags beneath them, a landslide of bruise-colored flesh. His jowls held the weight of the world. He began the process of putting himself together. Cover-up, filling in the crow's feet, concealer and color corrector, fish oil and zinc, calcium and vitamin E. No need for Cialis. Not hold up here. But he'd upped his Lexapro in an attempt to filter out some of the gray from the Zagreb pollution. He was just reaching for his Rogaine when his hand brushed across a heap of silken fabric on the dim counter. A scarf? He lifted it. Two slender pieces that came apart. Each was a skin-colored tube of fabric covered with elaborate patterns. Fake sleeve tattoos. He let them slip to the shag carpeting. His eyes lifted to the mirror. Barely visible in the dimness at the back of the room was the outline of a face. A man sitting on the upholstered settee, swallowed by the shadows. Rene forced a smile. "Evan," he said, loud enough for the surveillance equipment to pick up. "I knew you'd find me." Rene let his eyes tick over to that connecting door across the tile, checking to see if any movement interrupted the seam of light across the bottom. He pictured Dex readying the halogenated ether, the Greek henchman moving on Despy, the door opening and Dex filling the frame. Given that Dex was down to one hand, it would take him so much longer to do to Evan what needed to be done. The outline of the face stared back at him, a featureless mask. Rene stayed upright in his chair, staring at the reflection in the mirror. "The thing is," Rene said, listening for the hiss to come through the vents, "this situation is more complicated than you've accounted for." Something crashed into the mirror, leaving a red streak, and landed with a slap on the counter. Pill bottles skittered across the surface, bouncing on the floor. Rene shrieked. He stared down at the enormous hand resting on top of the jumble of knocked-over beauty products. Tattooed across it, an eerie, too-wide smile. His rolling eyes found the connecting door. For a moment he felt an irrational stab of hope. There were Dex's size 18 boots shadowing the gap beneath. Then the darkness spread and spread, seeping beneath the door, creeping across the tile. He felt his insides wither, his heart drop down the bottomless pit of his stomach. Still, it seemed, the nowhere man had not moved. Renee's throat seized up, too dry to speak. He croaked out the words, "You can have your money back." "I don't want my money back," the voice said. "What do you want?" "Someone once told me, if you control time,
You control everything.
The dark form rose and approached. Too terrified to turn around, Renee stayed locked in his chair facing the mirror. A hand drifted forward into a fall of light. It clutched a syringe filled with a viscous, clear fluid. Renee's mouth wobbled open as the needle slid into his neck. Still, the face remained lost to darkness. Renee's last thought before the thumb depressed the plunger was of the double-cylinder deadbolts on the front door, trapping him in. And then time stopped moving, sealing him inside it like a bug in amber. Her cell phone held at the ready, Candy leaned against the door to Renee's condo, straining to listen for movement inside. A single text to Orphan M, and Van Sciver would make it rain. The neighboring door creaked open. Just as she realized that it might belong to a connected condo, a streak of movement flew at her. She braced herself for a strike, but it didn't come. Instead, she was wrapped up, her arms locked to her sides, and then unfurled, a swing dancer who'd lost her lead. A face blurred by as he spun her. She recognized his eyes. For an instant, she let him lead. Not that she had a choice. And then she was free, tumbling across the threshold of the adjacent condo, the door slamming shut behind her. She slipped on something slick, slammed onto the floor, and came up sticky. She knew that smell. She lunged for the door, but knew all too well what she'd find. The double-cylinder deadbolts had auto-locked, and she didn't have a key. Her cell phone was missing, plucked cleanly from her hand. She thought of Orphan M below, waiting for her texted command. There was little she could do now, but brace for the drone missile. Orphan M held his cell phone in one hand, the GPS unit in the other, staring from screen to screen. He did not allow his knee to bounce with impatience. At last, a text arrived. "He's loose. I have him pinned on ground floor. Jam lock on front gate, and I'll herd him there." Orphan M input the front gate coordinates for the drone and then tossed the GPS unit on the seat, leapt from the Volkswagen and froggered across four lanes to the complex, dodging grills and blaring horns. He reached the tall metal gate, readying his pick set. He slid a slender diamond pick into the keyhole and snapped it off. There'd be no getting through that gate now. He sprinted back through traffic, nearly getting pancaked by a bus, and flung himself into the Passat before the next barrage of traffic swept by. The GPS handheld unit rested on the dashboard, not where he'd left it on the seat. Puzzled, he picked it up, turned it over. The battery lid was slightly loose, one of the screws lifted a few millimeters from the plastic. He stared at it uncomprehendingly, even as the reality dawned on him. The batteries had been taken out and put back in, which erased the previous coordinates and reset the unit to its own position. His body went cold, and he realized that it wasn't cold he was experiencing. It was a full-body panic sweat. His head lifted. Standing motionless in a sea of movement on the sidewalk across the street was Orphan X. He touched the imaginary brim of his beanie cap, gave a little nod. M had time only to lift his eyes to the roof of the car before the Volkswagen vaporized. 72. The Old Stories. Despy stepped out onto the balcony of her family apartment to water the tomato plants vining through the rails. Wherever her sister lived, she'd always insisted on growing her own tomatoes just like their mother did. Now, only Despy was left to maintain the family tradition. Sunset was heartbreaking here,
and lately even more so. Violets and oranges shimmering off the sparkling Mediterranean, another day finding its ultimate beauty as it was extinguished. Only a slice of the sea was visible between the surrounding apartments, but her father had always said that a slice was enough to feel blessed, to feel assured of your place in the world. How she missed him. How she missed them all. She stepped inside through the breeze-swept curtain and set down the watering can. Evan stood in her living room. Her mouth moved, but no sound came out. He removed a heavy-looking white envelope from his back pocket.
"What is that?"
"Pictures of the men who killed your family," he said, "who were watching you."
"I was being watched?"
"You were."
"What do the pictures show?"
"Corpses," he said. She swallowed.
"Where did you... how did you find them?"
"I found their names in a condo in Zagreb," he said, "where I caught up to Renee."
"He's dead?"
she asked. "Worse." She noticed that she was wringing her hands in her dress, and she made herself stop. She gestured at the envelope.
"What am I supposed to do with those?"
He said nothing.
"I don't want those. I don't want to see them."
He stuffed the envelope back into his pocket. "I didn't think you would. But I don't always know what people want." She looked at the watering can.
"I have nothing left. How am I supposed to rebuild their life?"
She'd seen him in a shock collar. She'd seen him beaten by men. She'd seen him on his knees. This was the first time she'd seen him powerless. "I can't help you with that," he said.
"Right," she said. "You're only good at destroying things."
She put her face in her hands and wept. When she looked back up, he was gone.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, though there was no one to hear it. No matter how many times Evan had been to the Parthenon, it never ceased to take his breath away. The rocky outcrop thrusting above Athens, the ruined temple thrusting up even above that, veins of mica and pyrite running through the marble, lending it a golden tinge, the perfection of the design, as precise as anything designed by computer. The ancient Greeks had even slimmed the Doric columns at the tops, an optical illusion to make it look as though the heavy roof were bowing the supports. Evan came around a block of scaffolding and spotted him from behind, sitting at a tiny cafe table in the shade of a food stand umbrella, sipping from a demitasse. Leave it to Jack to find espresso in an ancient citadel. Perspiration spotted Jack's shirt between the shoulder blades. Evan walked up from behind. As he drew near, Jack set down his demitasse. "Evan," he said, without turning around. Evan sank into the chair opposite him.
"Thanks for coming," Evan said.
Jack nodded. Two German kids ran by, tiny fists gripping bottles of Fanta Limon. Evan waited for their laughter to fade away and then said, "I thought maybe we could start over." "Okay," Jack said. "You said you don't understand why I still do what I do after I left the program. Why I didn't just disappear, lie on a beach somewhere, sip umbrella drinks." "Not my precise phrasing. But the gist." "Yes." Evan struggled to find the words.
"For as long as I can remember, I've been out in the cold, nose up to the glass, looking in. I may not get to come inside, Jack, but I'm sure as hell not gonna let the wolves in at everyone else. No. That's one thing I'm good for."
Jack looked heartbroken. He studied Evan.
You don't owe anything, son, for what I tasked you to do. It's on me. You've got nothing to atone for. I pulled the trigger.